Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Jeff Marsh, a worship associate, and I'm pleased to be leading today's service. I am joined this morning by Lisa Teal, a worship associate, Hal Walker, our director of music, Lily Rappaport, our director of religious education, with special assistance by Elaine Bowen, and the Fallow Time Folk Orchestra. We are delighted to welcome you to this religious community.
We light our chalice this morning with words from Khalil Gibran. If you would indeed behold the spirit of death, open your heart wide unto the body of life, for life and death are one, even as the river and sea are one.
Oh, McTavish is dead, and his brother don't go, and his brother is dead. McTavish don't go, they're both dead, they're in the same bed, and neither one knows that the other is dead.
The dead are always looking down on us, they say, while we are putting on our shoes or making a sandwich. They are looking down through the glass-bottomed boats of heaven as they row themselves slowly through eternity. They watch the tops of our heads moving below on earth, and when we lie down in a field or on a couch, drugged perhaps by the hum of a long afternoon, they think we are looking back at them, which makes them lift their oars and fall silent and wait, like parents, for us to close our eyes.
How many of you believe in reincarnation? Yeah, okay, so today's story is about reincarnation. So I'm gonna ask you, if you were to be reincarnated, what would you like to be? And shout it out at once. What would you like to be? Did I hear a pig out there? Would somebody like to be a pig? Okay, all right. So today's story is called A Pig's Life, and it's a story that's retold from southern India. Once upon a time, there was a guru who meditated for so long that he developed the gift of seeing into the future. People from all over came to see him because they wanted to know what was in store for them. But the guru was a little uncomfortable about sharing too much. So instead, he would say,
"Have faith, live a good life."
To be honest, he felt that knowing his future only made life more difficult. In fact, his knowledge about what lay ahead for him made it challenging to have faith at all sometimes. The problem was that he knew that his destiny was to become a pig in his next life.
A pig?
The guru had tried to live a good and pure life, and it puzzled him why he would have a strange and lowly destiny.
Maybe in past lives I've accumulated bad karma that I haven't yet paid off.
He fussed and he worried about the situation, and then remembering that he was a guru, he went back to meditation. And one day, he suddenly arrived at the perfect solution. He called his most loyal disciple.
Will you do anything I ask?
I'm your disciple. I know that if you ask me to do something, it would be for the good. Of course I'll do it.
Thank you. First, you must know that I am destined to be a pig. A pig in my next life.
Wow.
I'm certain it must have to do with my past lives. But you can help me. Please, after I die, watch for my birth. As a pig, I'll have the same birthmark on my forehead that I have now.
I see.
No hair. When you see me, you must kill me straight away.
Oh, I've never harmed anything. I'm not sure I could do such a thing.
I assure you, my plan is perfect. Pigs are unclean. It is no sin to kill a pig. And the sooner I die as a pig, the sooner I will move on to my next life on a higher plane.
The disciple trusted his guru, and he nodded in agreement. Yes, he could and he would do as the guru had asked. And so, not long after, the guru became ill and died. After the funeral, the disciple visited the neighborhood farms every day. The barns were dirty and smelly. He pinched his nose and avoided the mud pie so that he could check the animals in the pens. Oh, and he found the piglet right away. The piglet had a birthmark on the top of his head, and so he reached for his knife. And the pig was squirming, and it didn't want to say, it didn't want...
Stop! Don't kill me! As my loyal disciple, I command you, please do not kill me!
Now, the disciple thought he heard the pig talking, so he listened really closely.
Stop! Don't kill me! As my loyal disciple, I command you not to kill me!
The disciple was shocked. Should I obey the words of the piglet, or should I obey the words of the man? And so he listened even closer. The piglet continued.
I know that in my past life I told you to kill me, but that was before I knew what it was like to be a pig. The mud is so soft and silky. My mother's belly is warm and comforting. Her milk flows freely and tastes as sweet as honey. A pig's life is a good life. I truly believe that it is a fair reward for my past life.
And so, the disciple was more amazed than ever and a little bit relieved. He let the pig go and sat down next to its mother, and he watched the piglet snuggle up next to her. And then he walked down to wash the filth from the barn, and he shook his head thinking, how strange it is that you can know the future, and yet not understand anything at all. And so as you think today, maybe you can think about what loving the mud might be for you and how that might change your life.
Our wisdom words. On June 6th, 2011, Nancy Schaefer, a UU minister from Ann Arbor, was admitted to the University of Michigan Hospital with a brain tumor. She underwent surgery and started on a course of treatment. A dedicated poet, she captured and processed her experience through her writing. These were published in the book, while still there is light, writings from a minister facing death. The following are excerpts from her journey. June 12th. Other stuff I now know. It doesn't matter what shirt you put on in the morning or where your body fat is or isn't. God cares not a whit about which shirt or how your body looks. The point is love, which shows just as well in your white shirt as your blue one, just as well, if not more clearly, out of a battered body than a coiffed one. Cleanliness matters, yes, but not how you thought. In the first place is love. June 13th. Chemotherapy and radiation are next, I've been told. But what does this mean? Does it assume already some level of malignancy? Luckily, I am in completely new terrain. No previous conversations about immediate finiteness of my life. Perhaps overly cocky, I have been assuming that whatever I've got, my body and I can handle it and thrive. Besides, I am clear that the point is not getting through unscathed, but getting through as best I can. I'm up for that, again I tell myself. June 17th. It's true, I haven't had time yet to grieve. But more, what I need to cry is for gladness. How extraordinary that we live at all. And then on top of that is mostly such deep pleasure. It isn't grief so much as gladness I keep feeling. This extraordinary miracle we live, minute by minute, how I love it. June 23rd. There will come a time when I cannot do the simple things they ask. Follow light, exhibit reflexes, hold my hands out without them drifting down. The question in the meantime is how much love and presence surrounds all the changes, all the losses. Sometimes in the night, I hear myself begin to protest. But this isn't the way the story was supposed to turn out. But how do I know yet what was intended? I only know as much of the story as I've lived this far. Perhaps this is exactly the way it was supposed to turn out. June 27. How I wanted to live. I am, I realize later, in misery that first night. But during the deepest hours of it, as I wrestle the question of how to live through this even if I can't live through it, I understand this wrestling as perhaps the most significant piece of work I will ever do. I know what comes first. Living into my own wholeness, which is about calling, and of which I am certain. Creating as much beauty as I can, which is about writing, and also all other possible kinds of beauty, and which simply emerges from me, and being present in relationships, which is about my allowing my own holding of others and being held, and circles back to the love the surgeon began with. If I focus on these, I realize I will live through this, even if I die. July 16. This is not lost on me, given that I have a tumor that I am told will someday kill me. I also have the advantage that I must reflect now, while I am alive, on the meaning of my life and how I want to leave it. I might have died quickly. This is harder, perhaps, but exquisitely richer. I get to grieve for my own self. How tender and not to be missed is this? July 20. I don't cry easily, but I do cry regularly, or weep, rather. Seep tears when I am home and lying down thinking. In the night or resting, how could I not and be present? July 23rd. I'm getting questions about how I'm handling my news, my illness, emotionally, as though grief ought to be tidily boxed to one side, or apparent always. Neither. Some think I oughtn't make my way to each moment glad, or if I am glad, I must not be accepting what I've been told, likely no way out of an early demise. But the truth is, individual moments are not filled up with grief. They're just moments. With sun out, blueberries in a bowl, a point before me on the computer. Why should I not be happy moment to moment? A time may come when I am utterly sad without end. Just that isn't now. I've far too much to do and I feel well. Why should I miss this time I have? Of course I grieve, but it's mine to say how, when. December 6th. Yesterday, when I heard about the CT scan, I thought, I'm not ready if I am entering an end game. But I also know I'll never be ready. I will write and go to church and plant in the yard and do laundry and visit with people until the very end. I'll never be ready to leave this life, except I will be, of course. But in terms of still having projects I want to do and experiences I want to have, I will not ever be ready. April 15th. More about time and me now, remembering the night. I wake in the nest of creativity, the dead of night, where there is no agreement what to call this vast new thing, blackness, time, and origin, beginning again. How I love the dark. My altered sense of time and wakefulness is not annoyance, but welcome glee. Here is where the new begins. This was the last poem Nancy wrote. She died 6 weeks later in hospice near her childhood home in Davis, California.
My personal relationship with death has changed dramatically over the years. Throughout my childhood, we pretty much never spoke the word, almost as if bringing it up would somehow make it happen. Perhaps this attitude was colored by my old world grandmother and her constant fear of superstitious talk. But more likely, it came from my parents' desire to keep their kids happy, which in their minds meant free from suffering, free from any agitating thoughts even. But the weird thing was, death still happened, whether we spoke of it or not. The first person close to me to die was a great aunt who was never able to have her own children. We were her children, and so we're very close. There was never any mention of how sick she was. There was no mention of her being in the hospital, no mention of the possibility of her not being with us one day. You just don't speak of such things. So then, as you can imagine, it came as an intense shock to a young child who all of a sudden is confronted with this lifeless body in an open casket covered in way too much makeup, sort of resembling this person, but not really. I just could not wrap my young mind around this scene. I had no place to put it. And so I tried to block it out as I had been taught. In ninth grade, I was exposed to the poetry of Dylan Thomas. I sat in my little desk with jaw dropped as the teacher read with such passion, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." This confirmed my attitude even more. Run, avoid. There are many times I can recall where somebody had mentioned to me about the death of someone they knew, and I could feel myself squirm in awkwardness until the subject was changed. Fast forward to my adult life, where three very specific experiences happened to start altering my attitude toward death. The first was gifted to me by a friend who was dying of cancer way, way too young. I felt it was my duty to spend time with him in his last months to keep him company. As a friend, I didn't want him to feel alone and terrified. But I can remember the first time sitting in my car thinking, I don't want to go in there. This is too hard. I was literally nauseous. Yet after forcing myself to go inside, I soon realized that I was the one on the receiving end of a tremendous gift. While my friend had fought his illness while he could, once it became obvious that there was not going to be a recovery, somehow he found acceptance around his impending closure. He handled this cruel and untimely death with such grace and beauty that I actually began looking forward to our visits. I loved the sense of peace in that house. The next transformative experiences for me came thousands of miles away on some of my visits to India. I have a friend who has opened one of only 9 hospices in the entire country of over 1 billion. So as you can imagine, with so many people, this free service has filled quite a need. It came as a welcome relief to have a place for people to die better, better than in the streets or burdening their already struggling families. But this is a very unusual hospice where the emphasis is on having a spiritual death. There's no use of morphine except in the most extreme cases. The goal is for people to be lucid and continue to be engaged in life as much as they possibly can. Families are always welcome. The facility is designed with connected porches so that patients can easily move about and connect with others. All holy days are celebrated with the patients. All participate in daily prayers and songs, and they're encouraged to continue doing whatever they had enjoyed doing before their hospice stay, whether it be drumming or helping the cooks prep vegetables. As with visiting my friend who had cancer, my first visit to the hospice was also a reluctant one. We were just stopping by to pick up my friend who had started the hospice, and I was sort of hiding in the corner of the entryway when one of the staff saw me and, assuming I was there for a tour, handed me a hospital mask and started guiding me around. And with the language barrier, I had a little trouble objecting. But as I went room to room, things changed. The patients looked up at me from their beds and smiled with such tenderness, giving me the traditional namaste greeting. Their eyes were full of openness, a sweet welcoming, a desire to deeply connect with another. It's difficult to explain, but there was a sense of lightness throughout this place, and instead of simply enduring being there, I actually began looking forward to visiting a place of the dying. And during my visit there last year, I brought my son, and he brought his guitar, and we sat around with the patients making music together and singing. This was truly one of the sweetest moments of my life that I'll always treasure. The third experience that has shifted my attitude relates to my work as a yoga therapist with cancer patients, some of whom are healing and some who will never recover. I started this special training and teaching thinking that I wanted to give back and help people find some relief, some peace, some of the gifts that I had received from yoga. I remember telling a family member that I was beginning this journey, and his response was, "Wow, that's a real downer," and proceeded to change the subject. In my mind, I too sort of expected it to be a downer, but one that I felt I needed to do. And once again, I was the one given the gifts. These people changed my life. And when I thought of what I might be in their situation, I pictured a poor me attitude, hunkering down at home and generally feeling sorry for myself, maybe a little angry at life. To my surprise, they have been quite the opposite. It's as if they've realized how short their days are, and now is the time to live with as much peace and sweetness as possible. They want their days filled with authentic connection with others. I continue to be inspired by them every Saturday morning. I won't say that I've done all my work with my relationship with death, as I'm sure there's a lot more processing to be done, and I want to make sure that I don't diminish feelings of grief and loss. This is more about how this willingness, my shift in my attitude has deepened my spiritual practice. Death can stir up such intensity of difficult emotions that avoiding even thinking about it or acknowledging it caused me to limit my human experience. In the words of the great poet Rumi, "I learned that every mortal will taste death, but only some will taste life. I thought I was tasting life by avoiding the topic of death, but it was by opening myself up to these other experiences that gave me a greater ability to taste life, to live more wholly and with full heart."
Talking death with cake. I hope the title would be provocative and elusive enough for many of you, but some surely know to what I'm alluding. But first, some background. The experience of death has changed dramatically over the past century. Before the antibiotic era, there were often little options for real treatment of serious disease. Patients were treated in their own beds and recovered if they were lucky and had enough physiological reserve. The average age of death was in the 40s. Death at home, surrounded by family, was the norm. There was no avoiding exposure to the end of life. As medical interventions compounded, the care of the sick moved to hospitals, and it became an expectation that death could be held off indefinitely. Dying also became a more private experience, often occurring far away from family in an intensive care unit, hospital ward, or nursing home. This changed the personal experience that one would have had watching the process and preparing emotionally for the end. It became almost taboo to discuss death, and refusing the use of aggressive measures was compared to playing God. As death became more distant, we became more fearful and reluctant to face its inevitability. The hospice movement grew out of this void. Starting in the 1960s at St. Christopher's Hospice in England, Dame Cicely Saunders created an environment where patients could spend their few remaining days in comfort and in a home-like environment. It spread to the United States in 1974 and has become well-established over the past 40 years. However, facing the concept of death outside of the immediate needs of the dying remains a concern. Many people cannot have an open conversation on the topic without resorting to religious platitudes. In reaction to this hesitancy to openly discuss mortality, John Underwood got the idea to start a discussion group about death. John was a shy young man in London, England, with an interest in Buddhism. He was working as an unfulfilled web designer when he was inspired by the work of Bernard Cretaz, a Swiss sociologist. Dr. Cretaz published his experience leading conversations about death in Switzerland and France, where he called them Café Mortels. John formulated a plan to meet with a small group in his flat to start an unstructured discussion about death. It was facilitated by his mother. Tea and cake were served to nurture the body, as they hoped the conversation would nurture the soul. Their intent was to increase awareness of death while helping people make the most of their lives. They called their gathering a death cafe. The word of the death cafe was out. The movement spread. Soon it crossed the pond, and the first death cafe was held in Columbus, Ohio in 2012. Now there have been thousands of events in over 50 countries. These events share the commitment that they're not to be held for profit or promote a business. There is usually a moderator, but the conversation grows organically from the people who choose to attend. One thing that remains constant is the encouragement to combine talk about death with the nurturing presence of warm beverages and dessert, usually delicious cake. It takes nothing more than the initiative of the organizers and a comfortable space to hold an event. Attendees have reported that the discussions are not morbid or depressing. Often they are gilded with laughter. They are not intended to be bereavement sessions, but rather a shared inquiry into the mystery of death and the importance of living well. Boundaries are taken down and people become more comfortable discussing sensitive topics. John remained the leader of the movement with plans for a permanent brick and mortar death cafe, as well as an international conference. Sadly, he died unexpectedly this past summer of complications of leukemia at the age of 44. His wife recalled afterwards, he lived every day reflecting very consciously on the fact that none of us know how long we have, and focused completely on being present in and making the most of every minute. Talking about death can take many angles, but those that have attended these discussions find that the conversation often turns away from the fear and anxiety surrounding death towards the greater appreciation of life. Stories are shared about making the most of one's life so that there are no regrets as the end nears. This is why the book written by Reverend Nancy Schaffer is so powerful. She was diagnosed with brain cancer in June 2011 while serving as a called minister in Ann Arbor. She died a year later. She had been a writer and a poet and used the experiences to catalog her process with all of its triumphs and failures. The book starts with her diagnosis and surgery. She further reflects on how her surgeons talked to her, the discomfort of her radiation therapy mask, which she referred to as a medieval torture device, her return home to find that her landlord was putting her apartment up for sale, her preoccupation with food, her loss of hair, her cats, her struggle with a mail-order pharmacy delivering chemotherapy pills on time, and moving back home to Davis, California, where she lived the remainder of her life. However, through it all, she maintained a reverence for life and avoided self-pity. She continued to live as she had always done, cherishing her relationships and the beauty in her life. Do we have to wait for an illness to strike before we recognize the joy of life? In order to understand how best to approach life's appreciation, it is best to find a way to consider what comes after. As a hospice physician, I often hear patients and their families' expectations of a physical heaven. There is an expectation of a reunitement with dead spouses or other family, and a sense of joy that suffering is no longer. I'm not appreciating this sentiment, but wonder how the deferment of satisfaction helps make life more precious now. If I admit to myself that I doubt there is anything after our life here, does my appreciation of life suffer, or is it enhanced? Recently, I have heard life described as a hardcover book. Birth is the front cover and death the back. The characters are born when the front cover is opened, and they live their lives fully until the back cover is closed. They know nothing about what is on the other side, but it does not stop them from living on the pages. Huckleberry Finn is only concerned with his journey with Jim as he rafts down Big Muddy. He has no concerns about life past the final words. I take this to mean that life is to be lived while in the moment, and concerns outside of its fixed restraints is beyond any comprehension or control. We must make the most of the pages we have. The past year, I was touched by the life and death of a prominent member of society that I had the privilege to care for. He was a successful businessman who created a small restaurant empire out of a simple idea. He simply loved his family and gave back to his community in many ways. When he became ill of a blood disorder and did not respond well to treatment, he told his family that he was done and only wanted to be comfortable. His family responded by supporting his decision and surrounding him with affection. On his last weekend, his large Italian family threw a remarkable feast where all present could share in his life and could have a bit of time in his presence. He lived his life fully and without lingering regret. He died surrounded by the love that he spent his life sowing. The message: live ferociously, love openly, share relentlessly. Appreciate life and its unexpected pleasures. Like the guru who finds himself reborn as a lowly piglet, he recognizes only then the intense physical joy and comfort of rolling in the mud and suckling the warm milk of his mother. None of us can know how or when our end will come. Like John Underwood and Nancy Schaffer, we should try to embrace or enhance the lives of those around us and try to leave behind a legacy that makes the world a more peaceful and verdant place. And may we start this journey by openly accepting our limited time in this world and make the most of every single day. We should start now before we find ourselves facing the end of days. We should be open to discuss the mysteries with each other to help answer our own questions. And while we search for life's answers, don't forget the tea and a slice of delicious cake. And may it be so. Life is precious and often too short. Use your fleeting time on this earth to find love and to make the world a little more beautiful. Embrace your mortality, and in doing so, find a way to make the most of your life. Go forward in peace, love, and health.